Yeah.
Thank you, David. So yeah, this Blackboard lunch, I mean, the tradition is not only do the people from the different programs talk about the programs they're doing, but occasionally some of the locals talk about what we're doing. So I've been sitting in particular, the very nice biology talks, trying to figure out what biologists would find interesting about string theory. And in fact, right now, there is a natural answer to this question, because it seems that physics may be much closer to biology than we would like, in the sense that even at the most fundamental scales, the things we see are, to some extent, especially the details that we see, are to a large extent determined by historical accident and not by first principles. Now, this is speculative, it's controversial, but there's also a great deal of force and history behind it. It could all be wrong. Anyway, I will tell you what is going on. And I'll start by describing to you Kaluza-Klein theory. So Kaluza-Klein theory goes back to the early 20th century, when there were two known forces, gravity and electromagnetism, and they're pretty similar. They're both long-range forces. They fall as 1 over r squared. One couples to mass, one couples to charge. And wouldn't it be nice if somehow they were the same thing, if one were an aspect of the other in some fashion? And in fact, there's a very nice way this can happen, which was described by Kaluza and Klein, which is, suppose you have general relativity, although in some forms this idea is even older than general relativity. Suppose you have general relativity where space-time has more than three dimensions. Space-time has more than four dimensions. It probably has one additional dimension. So there are the three large space dimensions, large, greater than of the order of 10 to the 10th light years. And then an extra dimension, a fifth space-time dimension, which is too small to be seen. So the scale of this dimension is smaller than any then existing or now existing experimental apparatus, and so what this looks like to us is just we don't resolve what's happening in the extra dimension, we just see the large ones. Now the point is, if you think about gravity, general relativity in this higher dimensional space, well, general relativity is based on a space-time metric, which is a tensor field, has a couple of polarizations. And although, okay, so and so the, if you think about these two polarization vectors, there are sort of three possibilities. They can both point along the big directions, one can point along the big directions, and one can point along the small, or they can both point along the small dimensions. And so, although we don't see the small dimensions, these three states, these three kinds of graviton, or these three kinds of gravitational field, look different to us and manifest themselves in different ways. To us down here in four dimensions, not resolving what's happening, this looks like gravity. This, which just has a polarization vector, in fact behaves precisely like electromagnetism. And this is a scalar field, which is, for this simple model, kind of an embarrassment. But again, this is just the simplest model, but if you just focus on these two, it's extremely elegant, because you get Einstein's equations and Maxwell's equations out of just Einstein's equations. And in particular, what we see as charge is just momentum in the compact dimension. So it's very elegant. In fact, this both Einstein and Pauli, in particular, spent a fair amount of time thinking about this, trying to make it work, but that was premature. Now, I think this is a beautiful idea. You have one less force, but one more dimension. So it's not clear whether you've really gained or not, but it's certainly worth considering. And in fact, there are a couple of points of view from which this is a natural thing to consider. The first is, of course, that in general relativity, the shape of space-time is dynamical. It's not put in from the start. It's a solution to some equations, and there are many solutions. And there are certainly solutions that look like this. In fact, the three large dimensions are expanding. We know they were very much smaller once than they are now. At some point, all of the dimensions the now large and now small could have all been roughly the same size. And then what one is saying is simply that the Big Bang was asymmetric for some reason, which again is a natural thing to happen. But if the Big Bang is asymmetric, then in the course of time, a universe which is small in all directions will grow into something like what we see.
Can you say more about how embarrassing the scalars are in this context?
Yes, I will. Yes, I will, but I'll come back to it later on in a different language. Yes. Another way to think about this is in the language of broken symmetry. Namely, we know in many contexts that the underlying laws of physics are very symmetric, but the state we live in has a much lower symmetry, and much of the diversity of physics that we see comes about because of the asymmetry of the state arising from much simpler laws. This idea appears throughout particle physics and condensed matter physics. And this, of course, is a manifestation of broken symmetry. The laws of physics are symmetric under rotations in all four space-time dimensions, or all five, four space dimensions, all five space-time dimensions, whereas the state is less symmetric. It's only invariant under the symmetries of the visible three dimensions plus time. So in that sense, this is morally fairly similar to grand unification, where again, you start from one force, but because the vacuum, the state we live in, is asymmetric, it manifests itself as several different forces. In fact, you know, broken symmetry is now one of the central ideas in particle physics and also condensed matter physics. I think historically, although this language is not often used for the Kaluza-Klein idea, this is really the first proposal that the diversity of forces and diversity of phenomena at the most fundamental level come from broken symmetry. Okay, so that's Kaluza-Klein. And yes, question?
Does it say something about the quantification of
charge? Charge is quantized here because momentum, the wave function has to be periodic going around the circle. And momentum acts on that phase. So in fact, the quantization of charge arises in this picture precisely from the periodicity. Yeah. Okay.
So why 1 plus 4 is that you're going to come back to?
I'm going to come back to. That's one of the many accidents, maybe. But anyway, yeah. Okay, so now I want to fast forward to string theory. And string theory has many pieces. In particular, there's the one that gives it its name, which I'm really not going to talk much about, but I'll just remind you for completeness. It's just the idea, of course, that the basic building blocks, the quarks, electrons, neutrinos, photon, graviton, which as far as any experiment today are point-like. Under sufficient scale, there should be some kind of substructure or at least some kind of simpler theory, because the existing set of building blocks, there are too many of them, their properties are kind of complicated. There should be some simpler dynamics or simpler underlying structure that explains the diversity that we see. And string theory is the idea that under enough magnification, all of these things are little one-dimensional objects, and you have basically this one kind of building block whose different states of excitation can look like any of these things. Now, some of you already heard some of this morning, but I'm not going to also say much about why there's such an enormous convergence of theorists on this idea, but I'll just mention, I think the basic reason is the essential, that we're theory has become very rigid in the sense that we know enough now that it's very hard to make a theory that incorporates it all and is still sort of physically consistent. This goes back, again, really to the early 20th century, because once you have special relativity and quantum mechanics, it's very hard to combine even those. And combining those in a consistent way was a difficult exercise that went on for decades. Once you add in general relativity, gravity, it becomes harder still. And so in the absence of any direct evidence of what this substructure is, or any direct experiment that connects gravitational physics to particle physics, it really seems that from many points of view, theoretical consistency of various sorts pushes us towards this one picture. And indeed, as time has gone on, this idea has solved, it incorporates, you know, all of the things you know about particle physics, all of the general principles like special relativity, gauge symmetry. It incorporates the unifying ideas we were trying before, like grand unification and supersymmetry. And it also solves several of the problems of quantum gravity. And it's a structure which, again, theory is it's fairly rigid, and this it's a structure which is very compelling, clearly, from well. Anyway, so that's the basic reason, and that's so I say this partly because, of course, I'm sort of speaking to the biologists in the audience, and for the biologists, theory without experiment is sort of probably the opposite of the way things are supposed to be to first approximation. And it's amazing that it can work, or that it seems to be pushing us in a direction that we believe is makes sense. Now, the purpose for my purpose, the one thing about string theory that is important is that, again, for reasons of the internal structure of the theory, it forces on you a specific number of space-time dimensions, which is 10 or 11. That is, from in the language of symmetry, string theory has a lot of symmetry. It has not just the symmetry that mixes up three space dimensions, but it has symmetry that mixes up 9 or 10, as well as time. And again, this is an essential part of the structure. Again, this is fine, since the idea that there might be extra compact dimensions is an old one and is attractive for other reasons. It's just now that there are six of them, or seven. The geometries are much more complicated than just the circle of Kaluza-Klein theory. Okay, so of course the physics that we see in detail depends on the topology and the geometry, the detailed shape of this space, just as it does in Kaluza-Klein theory. And so the question is, what determines the shape of this space? And the answer is field equations, Einstein's equation. If there's no other matter present, if there's just geometry, just gravity, then some curvature is zero. More generally, there might be other fields present, and then there'd be terms on the right-hand side here. Now, if any of you were at Yao's public lecture about a month ago, he mentioned that early in his career, he set himself the problem of determining whether there are any solutions to this equation which are closed like this. And he showed that there were. They're now called Calabi-Yau manifolds, as a large class of solutions.
Is it finite class or is
it? Specific constructions produce numbers like 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 6th, possibly 10 to the, this of course is an important question. And specific constructions produce numbers like 10 to the 4th, 10 to the 6th, or 10 to the 8th, that kind of thing, combinatorics of topology. Although, in addition to the discrete choices of topology, there are also, for all of these solutions, continuous parameters. You can make them bigger or smaller, and they're still solutions. You can distort their shape, making one handle bigger or smaller. Those are called moduli, and you still get solutions. So you actually have some large, of order a million or something, not solutions, but families of solutions. So in this case, by the way, with only one dimension, it's much simpler. The only possible geometry is a circle, and the only parameter is its size. But once you have more dimensions, you have many, many more parameters. By the way, this extra scalar is an excitation that corresponds to fluctuations of the size. It comes from the metric. Correspond to fluctuations of radius of the circle. So it's present here, and it's present also in Yao's solutions. And okay, so now and it actually can't be there. Well, it's one of, I'll come back to this, but since you've already asked, the reason it can't be there is it would give rise to gravitational type forces that don't look like gravity. They don't satisfy the test of general relativity. So one of the problems with this, and one of the problems with this in the form that I'm now describing it, is it has these additional scalar particles. But that's going to go away. Now, the real question is, what determines which of these many solutions we live in? And you might imagine that it was some stability requirement, that one of these is more stable than any of the others. And somehow, in the course of cosmology, you would tumble and tunnel down and end up in the most stable one. But that's not true. They're all absolutely stable. Actually, I have to be precise. The subset that Yao found has an additional property besides these, an additional sort of geometric structure, which corresponds in physics to having supersymmetry. Supersymmetry is a symmetry between fermions and bosons. And it is not a property of our vacuum because we have the electron and there is no charged boson with the same mass as the electron. So we don't live in one of Yao's original solutions because we don't live in a world that's exactly supersymmetric. Now, in some ways, it's too bad because the supersymmetric solutions are very nice from many points of view. Supersymmetry is a very nice mathematical structure. It's not so obvious when I just describe it in this way, but it comes along with a lot of additional sort of, again, mathematical structure. One of the aspects of which is the following: the energy, the Hamiltonian, is the square of something. These are operators. It's the square of something, and it's the square of something which is real, which means this is bounded below. Actually, more generally, there can be a constant on the right-hand side. It's actually a negative constant. But that doesn't affect the statement that it's bounded below. And so for all of these different supersymmetric Calabi-Yau manifolds, there's an absolute stability because you can't go, once you get down to zero energy, you can't go any lower. So it's not stability alone that picks out one of these vacua. I'm waiting to hear what David thinks picks out one of them. But in any case,
You made the statement rather strongly.
What?
Do you understand the dynamics well enough to know that the condition of our stability is something to do with the Hamiltonian and the
Yes, in a certain, at some deep level, the answer is no. We don't have a complete formulation of string theory, and we piece it together from different approximations, different principles of physics. But modulo that, I'll say yes. If there's anything we understand well, it's the statement I made that these vacua are stable. Now, actually, Gary is here, and he spent several weeks trying to show that this wasn't true, and I believe those weeks were fruitless, right?
I think the point is that I now agree with you that, agree with everybody, that the energy is bounded from below, but I do not think that guarantees stability.
Because in gravity there's negative energy.
Well, because we now know there are negative energies, and negative energy densities, I should say, and very large negative energy densities, right, which can arise in some of these compactifications, and that can give rise to instabilities when you take a small amount of energy and do something sort of catastrophic.
But the issue, of course, is that to get to that lower energy state, you have to make a bubble, and the energy, the expectation is that the energy of the bubble wall is always greater than what you gain. And do you think there's still a question there?
Well, this is not the time.
Anyway, I say the answer is yes. I say the answer is yes. If there's a weak point in what I'm saying, it's not here. Actually, yes. There's a large set of them which have zero energy, and therefore they can't tunnel because they're degenerate. And to get from one, when a vacuum tunnels, you first have to, it's like superheated water. You first have to make a bubble of.
One can be in superposition of this
thing. Initially you could, but you'd reduce it. Now there's another, but there's a stronger statement which comes back to it. I did say you have both zero energy and negative energy supersymmetric solutions. In gravity, When gravity inhibits tunneling, this is a surprising result due to Coleman and DeLucia. And so a lot of the reason these things cannot tunnel to each other is because of the way the gravity. What happens is you try to make a bubble of the lower vacuum in the new vacuum. You try to nucleate the lower energy vacuum. And the problem is the bubble gets so big that the effects of general relativity come over and don't let it get any bigger, in rough terms. So you can imagine, in fact, we will imagine a cosmology where you initially heat it up, and in time, you come down and populate different vacuum. But once you're in one of these, you can't go anywhere. Anyway, we don't live in these anyway, because they have Fermi-Bose symmetry. Now, we live in a state that's not supersymmetric. It's the space, the geometry is less symmetric in some way, and consequently, the particle spectrum is less symmetric in some way. And unfortunately, these are much harder to describe than the supersymmetric ones. In fact, I think it's safe today that no one has reliably constructed any example of a non-supersymmetric vacuum of string theory, which is known to be stable or at least sufficiently long-lived to be our universe. But the problem there is not really one of principle. It's just that things are messy. We're starting with a theory, string theory, that has no dimensionless parameters. There is no expansion parameter. And we want to talk about states that we can study in a quantitative way, a reliable way. And so these non-supersymmetric states have every reason to exist, but they would kind of naturally be in the middle of things where there's no obvious small parameter to study them with. The Calabi-Yau spaces are nicer in that respect because, A, they're basically because supersymmetry gives you tools to study them beyond, well, gives you a lot of tools to study them, but also because, for example, they have a limit where the manifold gets very large, you can study them in that approximation. You have many, many more tools for these solutions, which again are supersymmetric and which have many, many moduli that you can use to go to simplifying limits. But we've certainly, well, obviously, since so many of us are working on string theory for so long, we certainly expect that these stable non-supersymmetric vacua of string theory exist. And in fact, in the last few years, there has been substantial progress towards describing them. There is a recent paper, for example, by Kashru, Kalosh, Trivedi, and Lindy, which gives not so much an example, but a scheme for constructing the non-supersymmetric ones by identifying ones which are, in a rather precise sense, close to being supersymmetric. And they are able to describe an expansion around, in some sense, the supersymmetric limit. And in that limit, they argue you can show that these vacua exist and that they are long-lived. It's interesting that they are not absolutely stable. There's actually no reason to expect. There's no evidence for any non-supersymmetric state of string theory which is absolutely stable. And if that's true, then the state that we live in is not infinitely stable over some unimaginably long time. It has modes of decay which would be catastrophic, and which would quickly lead to singularities. So when one hears talks about the ultimate fate of our universe, there's a lot of microphysics that we don't know that isn't yet taken into account, but the most obvious one is that we probably don't live, according to our current understanding of string theory, which might change tomorrow, but according to our current understanding of string theory, and one which really has been around for a while, we don't live in a stable state, but we can live in one. We can live in one which lives for a cosmologically long time. In particular, the states that Kashru et al. Describe, which are close to supersymmetric states, live for a very long time. I mean, for those of you who want details, the sense in which, the measure of which they differ from supersymmetric states is a single number. It's a constant in the superpotential, if any of you have ever played with or looked at supergravity models. You can parameterize for large classes the supersymmetry breaking by a constant in the superpotential, and if that is small, then their construction works, and you can find these states.
I thought these theories were scale free. So what means long-lived and what means short-lived?
Well, string theory String theory comes with it an intrinsic scale, which is this the size of a string. the corresponding time. So they're not in that sense scale invariant. The question is, how do you get from a theory which has only one scale in it, which is some tiny number of fraction, some tiny fraction of a second, to a lifetime which is cosmological out of purely dimensionless numbers? Because that's what you have to do in string theory. You don't have any dimensionless numbers to start with. In this scheme, the small number, again, is this distance from a supersymmetric state that I was mentioning. And because tunneling amplitudes generally go as exponentials in 1 over the small parameter, it doesn't take an incredibly small parameter to generate a long-lived theory. Okay, so we are starting to develop the tools to find non-supersymmetric vacua of string theory for the first time. And it's, again, not surprising they're there. And also not surprising there are probably a lot of them. Again, it's hard to estimate them, but the kinds of constructions that Yao introduced, again, you talk about numbers that might be between 10 to the 5th, 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 8th. And if that were the end of the story, then things are not so bad. 10 to the 6th vacua, say, each of which has different physics in 4 dimensions, is not so incredibly awful. You can use a few coarse, well, first of all, you might hope that there is some dynamical principle, the initial condition or something, that would pick out one of them that you would have to live in. But that does seem kind of far-fetched. More likely, there's some evolution. There are several possible basins of attraction, many possible final states. But with a number even as large as, say, 10 to the 6th vacua, it's not so hard to imagine sort of sieving through them with a few coarse experimental facts, identifying the one or a small number that we might live in, and from that point on having the ability to make detailed quantitative predictions.
Are all of these vacua singularity free?
No. One of the things, of course, that string theory has taught us is how to understand spaces that have what would, from the point of view of general relativity, be singularities. What we would, you know, now this is some kind of brain. It's a D brain or an M brain or an orbifold. But, you know, we understand them. And actually, a lot of the models that lead to sort of interesting low-energy theories with matter, with chiral matter like us, there's a large class where the matter lives on just such a singularity. And, you know, in some sense, those are no better or worse than the older smooth geometries, such as the Clausius geometries. But they're also more interesting, and that's where, as you know, most of the current effort lies. So there's one possible story. 10 to the 6th vacua, which are kind of ugly because they're not infinitely stable, they're just long-lived, but they can be understood, again, by starting with these fairly attractive supersymmetric vacua and looking nearby. Now,
your argument would be that ones mm-hmm. which are far from these attractive supersymmetric vacua are much less likely to live for a long time.
Yeah, actually, there's one good thing. These theories have small parameters, and the small parameter plays two roles. One of them is it lets us study these vacua in a reliable expansion, but the second is it allows the vacuum to live for a long time. So fortunately, there's at least some indication that we live in a space that can be quantitatively understood for that reason.
But then it would also mean that the supersymmetry and scale, which is broken, is much, much lower than Planck scale, and that's forcing.
It doesn't have to be, for the purpose of the Kochrude construction, much could be 10 to the minus 3 times the Planck scale. It doesn't have to be the weak scale. And I'm not going to get into details of scales here, because I'm talking at a much coarser level than that.
That's the first application of the anthropic principle.
I don't think so.
Supersymmetry breaking the small so that we can reliably
Just a fact. It's a fact that there are large ratios of scales in nature, like the age of the universe compared to the string scale. And given that observation, that probably traces back to some fundamental small parameter.
Why not invoke the entropic principle?
I didn't need it.
The scales were the same, we obviously couldn't.
I didn't need it yet, so I didn't invoke it.
So this is a mixed audience. Yes. That seems a very dangerous assertion. I mean, most small parameters in kinetic matter physics don't go back to some basic small parameter. They just happen in some situations, they don't happen in others.
So
not possible parameters you might bend in, there's likely one of them likely to be small enough to be
sort. Yeah, I'm saying the same thing. That is, I mean, in any given system, you have to identify something simpler that you're close to.
Right, but it may not be because of something underlying.
Back
at the beginning.
Right. Although this stability, because there are many modes of instability, many potential modes of instability, and stability against all of them suggests that you're close to supersymmetry. Yeah. In particular, there are many. So I'll just leave it at that. You can tunnel to sort of large supersymmetric vacua. You can tunnel. There are various. The non-supersymmetric ones are uglier. They've got fluxes. They've got quantum fluctuations. They've got brains, and a lot of those things are sort of excitations that can decay away. And so, that this has in fact been the problem is that really going back 20 years trying to find vacua which are stable, they have so many ways they can kind of sneak out to lower energy that it's taken a fairly complete understanding of the dynamics to start to find examples. Okay, so now the last part, which is the reason for thinking that in fact the story might be even worse as far as, well, predictability, elegance, whatever. And this is the problem of the cosmological constant, the problem that the vacuum doesn't gravitate. The theory, okay, so our vacuum is full of stuff. Just from the standard model, it's full of the fields that break the weak interaction. It's full of strong color fluctuations. And so just including things that we know about, the energy density of the vacuum is at least of order the weak scale to the fourth. And that is only true, in fact, if supersymmetry holds down to this scale. Otherwise, effects from even higher energy would give a number of order m Planck to the fourth. And the experiment, the observation, is that it's 10 to the minus 60th of this scale, or 10 to the minus 120th of this scale. And of course, this is incredibly, remarkably wrong prediction. And I have seen in 20 years an incredible number of wrong ideas on this subject. This might be just one more than I'm telling you about now. I've seen enough wrong ideas that if each one just gave you a factor of 10, you'd be fine. But anyway. Yes. I'm serious. I count them for you. I'm serious. Yes.
You don't actually know that any of those are wrong.
Well, yes, we do. Okay. So, yes. Yes.
It would just be lovely at some stage if you say, how would you ever know whether your theory was right or wrong? We biologists don't have that problem.
Well, we do. Yes, and unfortunately, let's talk about that at the end because. Let's talk about that at the end. This is why David doesn't want me to give this talk. Okay. As I'm saying, it's about to get worse. If you ask about these non-supersymmetric vacua that I've been talking about, again, their vacuum energies are not zero. So, by the way, we used to think back when a vacuum energy hadn't been seen, when it seemed, as far as you knew, it was zero, and it was so much less than the natural scales that we assumed it was exactly zero, it seemed that there must be some elegant dynamical or symmetry principle that we were missing that would explain why it was exactly equal to zero, which we never found. And it's probably good that we didn't find it, because now, in fact, this has been seen, and it's non-zero at just the level that can be detected. This is the acceleration of the universe, the supernova measurements, the fact that 78% of the energy in the universe is vacuum energy. And there are thoughts that maybe this is time-dependent, that it's quintessence, but certainly within string theory, it's much easier to understand a constant one than a quintessent one, and so I'll assume that it's a constant. Now, there was one of the many wrong ideas was the following, that, and this is an idea that Hawking in particular has pursued over the years. It actually came out of supergravity. He didn't invent it, but it's the idea that the vacuum energy consists of a whole bunch of stuff, you know, quantum fluctuations, Higgs fields, and so on, and one more contribution, which is the energy of some kind of, a particular kind of field that fills the universe. It's called a four-form field strength. And it has the interesting property that its field equations require it to be constant. So this is a term which can take any value, but whatever value it takes the same value everywhere in space-time. And so if this is negative and the strength of this field is just right, then the sum is zero. So you have a potential, you have states at least, you have the potential to describe, to have a theory which has vanishing vacuum energy. The reason this, so, and then the question is, of course, why does it take that precise value? And that's where there are many discussions that we don't need to go into, because this is one of the wrong ideas. The reason it's the wrong idea was shown by Raphael Busso and I a few years ago. It's that this field strength is quantized. It can't take continuous values. It's quantized in kind of microphysical units. So this is not a real number. It's basically an integer. It's an integer with some normalization here, which is like this or like this. The steps are large. So you don't have this ability to finally adjust this term to cancel this term. But we noticed that there were a lot of vacua of string theory which had many of these four-form field strengths. And if you, in fact, as many as 100, say, if you consider a complicated topology for the compact dimensions, and if you have 100 field strengths and each of them is sort of quantized, but they're quantized with different normalizations, then combinatorics will generate for you a very large set of possible vacua, each with a different energy. So you have a spectrum of possible universes, which each of them has, it's absolutely discrete. It's fixed by ultimately integers. But you have enough choices for the values of those integers that the number of vacua starts to get rather dense. It could be as large as 10 to the 60th or more. So even though the overall scale of the energy density is still microphysical, there will be a few that are within sort of the allowed range. This is zero, and this is the critical density, and this is the observed number here. And, you know, barring someone having some clever idea, some clever other idea for why zero is a preferred value when you add up all of these diverse contributions to the energy density, the only way we know now to do that is, in fact, to be lucky, or better, to have so many vacua. And now we're talking not about 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 8th, but 10 to the 60th or 10 to the 120th, that one or more lie in this range.
I'm a bit confused. You said
yes.
That the scale here was like 10 W.
So
they were integers.
They're integers.
How do I get 10 to the minus?
Because you have you have a sum of many quantized things which with different that which are incommensurate. And so as you add them up and consider it,
They're integers times irrationals, basically.
Thanks. I didn't want to say irrational because I never thought that rationality would have any effect on physics. They could simply be rational with large denominators. Anyway, let's say they're integers times different irrationals. Thank you for clarifying that. They're integers times irrationals, and so they can add up to a wide range of distinct values.
What is the density of states of?
Well, okay, what's?
Are they presumably not uniform in this picture?
Well, statistically, they're on the scale of this picture, they're uniformly distributed because there's nothing special about zero. The overall normalization of this axis is 10 to the 60th times what you see here, and on that scale, there might be smooth variations of the density. But now here one is looking at such a fine scale that the spacing is purely random. It's not even random in the sense of a Wigner semicircle over some repulsion. It's just random because it's a complicated system with many degrees of freedom.
But then it's not especially likely still to get out particular value.
Okay, so now this I want to pause here. Because so far I'm talking about string theory, which is something where I have some credentials, and this may not be right. This ability to understand the space of vacua of string theory, and especially the non-supersymmetric ones, is just in its beginning, and happily, it is probably going to progress rapidly, although it will certainly take a very long time to have a complete understanding. But there is a question here: can this possibly be right? Are there really 10 to the 60th or more vacua of string theory? We've got some set of equations. Do they really have 10 to the 60th solutions? 10 to the 60th distinct solutions, which satisfy some range of criteria like stability? We don't know.
Joe,
yes.
Something which you thought had a continuous moduli. You made it discrete.
Yes. Sorry.
I'm obviously excited that you have 10 to the 60 instead of a continuous.
Sorry, I should have said something more. Sorry, I actually left out a logical thought there. Yeah, let me insert that and then. I'm sorry. This thing about flux integers, is actually just a toy model of a much more general issue. Thank you. Which is this is one way and a rather simple way to generate large numbers of solutions to the field equations of string theory. But there are many others. They're all topologies of the manifolds and so on. And topology can generate rather large dimensionless numbers starting from no large numbers, large integers starting from no numbers. So the question is actually more general in this context of just the fluxes. But in this entire space of solutions to string theory, are there really so many that this purely statistical argument would explain why there's at least one of the order that we see? Okay, so one of the questions was, how does one know if one's theory is right or not? Well, this is not an experimentally testable question, but it's a theoretically testable question. When you understand the space of solutions to your equations, does it really have so many? Or is it really a number like 10 to the 6th, 10 to the 8th? And
so I have a more basic question. Why is it these states?
Yes.
How do you know those are the right things to be looking at? I mean, there are certainly lots of dynamical situations where you can actually look in terms of eigenstates or so on, and they turn out not to be very misleading and not in fact the right things one wants to look at for a time-dependent problem. So
well,
this is another situation here. I mean, this may be related to Gary's comments.
I mean, we're.
Things earlier.
I mean, well, we're observably in a system where. The microphysics is possibly time. I mean, the microphysics is approximately time translation invariant. So experimentally, at the level of what the vacuum is doing, we're in an eigenstate. I mean, I'm sure.
No, we're in some. We could be in some linear combination of eigenstates, which could be very different from each other, and so on.
Well, there's a general argument with vacua that you never get into superpositions of different vacua because the wave function reduces very quickly. Cluster decomposition. You know, we're not.
Vacuum.
Yep. we're not in the linear
We're on the vacuum. Either.
I mean, we're not in linear combination of two vacua, in one of which alpha is 1 over 137, and one of which it's 1 over 10, because one observation would establish we're in that one. Even if we started in a linear combination, one observation puts us in that one. This is decoherence, and I don't really understand it. But, I mean, there's a general question of how you go from...
No one else does either, right?
I mean, right, no, no, but... Right. But this is a non-string theory question. Why do we think we're in the approximately classical state in the quantum world? I'm not going to answer that.
But that's... No, the difference between being in approximately classical state and saying that one is in a
In a ground state.
Like a ground state. It doesn't mean those are the same thing.
The reason that we're close to the ground state is the expansion of the universe dilutes energy. I mean, once you're in sort of a region which is approximately described by general relativity, you know, you get closer and closer to the vacuum because...
Locally,
some of the vacuum.
I mean, I don't know if it's
global or local
issues. I'm
confusing.
Well,
it could have been that there are domains.
Well, actually, let me finish, in fact, because you said domains. So the question is, what would, in fact, end up putting us in So the testable question, the testable theoretical question is just when you know, how many solutions are there, and this is not just my craziness here. As I said, there's a serious train of thought in the subject, including people who really sort of build these vacua, like Mike Douglas, that the number of vacua might be so large, in fact, that predictive power in the normal sense is really minuscule, and you have to start thinking about things statistically. Okay, so there's still a missing link, which is, even if everything I've said so far is true, why, in fact, do we observe a value in this tiny range, which is a small fraction of the total range of possible values? This is a cosmological question, and so it depends on many things that we don't know, but there's at least one very simple answer to that question, which is the universe starts out hot in some excited state, and it cools, it expands, and you know, there's lots of these states you can be in, and you get caught in these states for a while because they're long-lived. And if you're in a state, so this is now way, way up on the tower, not down here close to zero. If you get caught in a state which is long-lived and has a positive energy density, you inflate. And if it's very long-lived, you inflate a lot. It's really kind of incredible how big a universe the equations of general relativity can make. I've never understood where all that stuff comes from, but that's what the equations say happens. And if you make an enormous expanding universe out of one of these false vacua, eventually it will start to nucleate bubbles of these lower vacua. And under some set of conditions, this will go on forever. This is Lindy's eternally expanding universe, and the conditions for that seem to be satisfied within some subset of string vacua, meaning that the false vacuum expands so rapidly that even as you nucleate these lower lying states and these bubbles begin to expand, they never collide and they never fill the larger universe. It's expanding faster than the bubbles within it. And in the course of time, old inflation, and in the course of time, you populate every single one of these. Of course, old inflation didn't work as an explanation for where our matter came from, so you have to suppose that, in effect, new inflation is another module here, which is new inflation, but that's not relevant to what I'm about to say. The main point is that in this purely dynamical scenario, vacua whose cosmological constant is negative and any larger than rho critical would already have collapsed. And now this is an argument due, I think, to Steven Weinberg. And vacua whose energy density is positive and more than 10 to 100 times the rho critical would have expanded so fast, they would expand so fast that galaxies never form. There's just diffuse matter. So you have this enormous...
More than 10 to 100 times.
Sorry?
than more than 10 to the 100 times?
More than 100.
More than just 100?
10 to the 2. Okay. 10 to the 2. 10 to the 1 or, sorry, thank you for, 10 to the 1 or 10 to the 2. This is Weinberg's argument. And so you end up with a universe with many bubbles, most of which are either empty or have long since collapsed to singularities. And only a tiny fraction of them all have galaxies in them. And, I don't want to say, I actually didn't want to put anthropic in the title, but it's obvious that we live in a galaxy. This is the galactotropic principle. Obviously, in this universe, if you ask where observers will be, they're not going to be here, and they're not going to be here, so they're going to be in one of these. Now, it's an interesting point that this argument, which goes back to Weinberg, would allow, if you take a random value from the allowed range, it would typically be 10 or maybe 100 times larger than the observed value of the cosmological constant. But this now becomes sensitive to fine assumptions about things. Unfortunately, one is now in the situation that predicting the constants of nature depends on understanding how galaxies form rather than the other way around, which is the way it's supposed to be. And so, but in any case, this comes within a factor of 100, which is at least 58 orders of magnitude better than any of those other 120 ideas. Okay, so, you know, it's awful. As I once told Sean Carroll that if the cosmological constant were observed, I would give up physics, and obviously I haven't. I actually had a brief, I woke up one morning about 2 months ago thinking, this is awful, I'm not going to take on any more graduate students. And then after a couple of days of reflection, I realized, no, that's the wrong attitude. I just need 10 to the 60th graduate students. But you know, there clearly are well-defined scientific questions here, because again, we're just at the very beginning of understanding both the space of vacua and also how cosmology works in string theory. And it may be that as time goes on, the picture that I described will continue to be the standard model, or something, you know, really neat will come along and take its place. So anyway, this is the price that one pays for basically Kaluza's idea. The physics up in 10 or 11 dimensions is absolutely, totally fixed by first principles. There is no choice. There is a unique theory. But the physics that we see in 4 dimensions depends on the geometry, and that's now a solution to field equations and brings in history and other kinds of history, randomness, and so on. So, thank you.
Are you
going to
ask a question?
Which question is that? You're
right or wrong.
I'm sorry. So, again, I the only good answer I have now is that there are still internal theoretical questions. Does the space of vacua look anything like this picture that I drew, or is it really very much smaller? This is not what a biologist would call a prediction. But it is a prediction because, you know, a priori, the estimates, the simple topological estimates of the number of solutions gave numbers like 10 to the 6th or 10 to the 8th. This requires 10 to the 60th, and if there turn out to be less than 10 to the 60th, it's been falsified. If there are 10 to the 60th, well, you can call it a successful prediction. It's a theoretical prediction, but it's one that can be tested. It's a mathematical question, but it's...
That's what slightly worries me.
Yes?
Isn't this all just mathematics? Has it anything to do with the real world at all?
Well, you know, it's... Right, so there is a statement that is something sometimes made, that theories need to be falsifiable, say in an experimental sense. Now, I take a different point of view, which is that there is some external reality there. There is some set of dynamical laws which we don't get to choose, which determine everything. And those laws may be more or less predictable than we would like them to be. In the past, with quantum mechanics, they would be less predictable because quantum mechanics is in some ways less deterministic than classical mechanics. But of course, we live with it because there are many things it does predict. You know, obviously, again, one can imagine a bad outcome here where nothing is ever seen. That's bad. There are also lots of good outcomes. There's this possibility that these extra dimensions will, in fact, be detected. I mean, that's a small part of parameter space, but if you see it, you don't. Okay, so there is supersymmetry. There is cosmology. There are sort of a lot of areas where, with in each individual case, small probability, you can see something new, and one doesn't know yet. I mean, there is a possibility that one has it's a logical possibility that the dynamical laws that govern our universe, that large parts of them aren't accessible to experiment. But again, we're in the, in some ways, fortunate situation that theory is very rigid. The first example of this was the prediction of antiparticles. That, you know, you try to combine special relativity and quantum mechanics, and when you finally find something that works, you know, it's right. And it, in that case, of course, it made a prediction that was initially seen ridiculous and was proven to be correct a few years later. I mean, given our current level of understanding, it's hard to say where and when. Yeah, I'll just leave it at that. There's a lot we don't know, and a lot. Yes.
I don't think it was about string theory in general.
Yes.
Well, it might have been.
Yes.
But it was about anthropic arguments. So in other words, when physics gets around to saying that certain of its parameter space, or even the law, somehow.
Right. Right.
Certainly, fundamental constant, otherwise constants of nature, depend on previous history.
Mm-hmm.
And are uncalculable. Then,
yes.
I mean, it's a fair question to ask. In what sense is that a scientific statement, or it's testable?
Right.
In other words, we can't go through different histories. And in this scenario of anthropic principle, we can't actually observe these other universes. They would have different parameters.
Yeah,
I mean,
I tried to
use the principle as a predictive one.
Right.
But I think we agree that it's pretty far-fetched.
Well, I don't want to say that it's far-fetched. I want to say that I hope it doesn't turn out that way. Again, I'll repeat my statement. There is some set of dynamical laws which we don't get to choose that governs our universe. It may be something like what I've described. It may be something more amenable to experiment. If it's something like what I described, then indeed, verifying that is going to be difficult, impossible, at least a very long, you know, it's going to be a largely theoretical procedure. But that's the worst case. I mean, that's the worst case. Yes, sir.
Weinberg's argument presumably also depends on the density of dark matter, which depends on other properties of physics. Is there any reason to believe those are more stable than the energy density of the vacuum in string theory? Because it's really ratios.
Right, right.
Weinberg's argument allows all dark matter ranges.
Sorry, you say it's consistent? Yeah.
An extreme case on both ends.
Yeah.
Weinberg's argument is you adjust the dark matter to be whatever would work best for that cosmological constant. This is the range.
Well, you know, I can make the dark matter. I can make rho vacuum a billion times bigger.
No.
Rho dark matter a billion times bigger. I make a Lilliputian galaxy.
No, it doesn't work that way.
No, yeah, because the amount of time you have depends upon how much. I make a Lilliputian universe, which is 10^-4.
Well, but I mean, there's some kind of two-parameter space. But the question is, well, how much the cosmological constant axis depends on the dark matter axis, and I would guess it's small. Right. I mean, there's been a fair amount of elaboration of that bound, but I don't think it changes it in a radical way. Gary?
But I mean, you've now narrowed down the range. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is the one observation you have.
Yes.
So does it lead to anything? Suppose you pick that point and say, well, okay, I'll find out sometime in the future that I live in that vacuum.
Right.
Does it tell me how many particles I have, how many interactions I have?
if the number of vacua is 10 to the 60th, then yes, if it's 10 to the 80th, I mean, you know, it's only under optimistic circumstances, but it depends, of course. I mean, you know, calculating this number, it's a sum of many, many things. Calculating it to one part in 10 to the 60th. I mean, I'm not kidding about 10 to the 60th graduate students.
There could be something. 10 to the 160th. There's a very optimistic scenario, which is that all the vacua with small cosmological constant have SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 symmetry, for example.
That all of them do.
All of them. I agree that's very unlikely.
It's a pretty coarse prediction. By the way, I should mention, I know there's some visiting graduate students here, and I should tell you not to take this too seriously. I mean, I do real physics too, like string theories of QCD, but that was less fun. Anyway, that was less fun to talk about. So just don't take the wrong message away from this.
John, I want to comment on this question about how much you know what you're talking about at all.
Okay.
yes. My memory understanding of history is almost certainly wrong, but if 12 years ago, whatever it was, one had said that around a large black hole, mm-hmm. one had to worry about issues near the event horizon, the black hole, we had to worry about issues that were to do with enormously high energies and enormous mm-hmm. small scales to resolve any of the seemingly semi-classical paradoxes with thermodynamics around yes. black holes. Presumably you would have made the same argument. Well, we know, I mean, it's all big scales, nothing right on there. So, and one would have said, that, you know, how could strength of
good.
So therefore, I don't see why we should buy these arguments about when you're at ground state and one can do with semi-classical.
Well,
what's going on is right.
Well, I insist we're obviously near a ground state. That's what a vacuum is. It's a ground state. I mean, I'm not sure what you're driving at there, but I mean,
Are you talking in cosmological terms? You're worried about?
No, I'm worried about whether this thing of saying we are in one of these ground states or near one of these ground states is a reasonable statement to make. And why should one be?
How do you decide?
We're not time translationally invariant universe.
Locally we are. Locally we are. The universe is time. I mean, the breaking of time.
So locally, that means we have to be in some combination of states, which are not just ground states, they're excitations and so on.
No. I mean, locally, we're.
But you're making the local and global argument again, which is.
I'm sorry. I guess we're stuck.
Around black hole event horizons and saying, therefore, you should never have to worry about there.
I mean, locally, you know, there's not a lot of stuff here. We're close to, I mean, right, the system that we're in is a good approximation translationally invariant. I'm not sure, you know, what the, yeah.
But if there's some parameter in which one's moving along continuously,
yes.
you can have things in which they're going to be,
it's called the metric,
which is unbound, which is unbounded, and you can go all the way. You can keep moving along and be in, as you're going along, be in something which is, sort of well behaved in
the
local senses, but there's no sense in which you're not
going to be. The laws of physics are not changing in time. I mean, that is, first of all, a bit of evidence that we're in. I'm not sure, a state that's not evolving.
The question of rapidity of them changing.
Yeah, right. But also, for something to change on time as slowly as it would have to. Requires, I mean, an incredibly flat or slow change. It's hard.
Given the amount of unreasonableness in what you're saying to begin with, I don't see why the other thing is more reasonable question.
But remember, these different vacua, for example, have different values of the fine structure.
Right.
So you're saying we could be in a superposition?
Yeah.
Two states.
I didn't say we were in a superposition as in a vacua. I said, how do we really know that we're near to a vacua?
We're not in the vacuum,
pure state.
Right.
Right.
What kind of state?
Superposition. Well, we're in some low energy, linear combination of low energy excited states around that vacuum, but very far away from where the vacuum is.
Around that pure state. Around that one state.
But very far away from it.
Okay.
But
that doesn't bother John.
Wait, I'm not even sure. I'm not bothered. It doesn't bother if they don't understand it.
Energy is the metric in some sense. When you say low energy, in Joe's sort of point of view, that is close to the ground state. It's somehow energy.
But close to ground state in what sense? I mean, we've got all these enormous number of parameters. Some of them continuous. Some of them can run off to.
I'm sorry. I should have said something, which is that the non-supersymmetric states are especially the ones in particular that have been described by Kashubi, any one are isolated. They don't have the continuous parameters in general. Those continuous parameters, like the Kaluza-Klein one, are properties of supersymmetric vacua. Sorry, I should have said this. But as soon as you have any kind of energetics, you have a potential for them. And if we were not sitting near, right at the bottom of that potential, we would see the effects of moving around. It would gravitate. There's kinetic energy there that would gravitate. We know that there's not a large kinetic contribution from some motion of some field to the energy density of the universe.
Except for all those photons,
but that's close to the vacuum at the level of microphysics, because 3 Kelvin is much less than the weak scale. I mean, that's a measure. 3 Kelvin is a measure of how far we are from the vacuum.
And we're at 100,000, okay? Since you were talking about large numbers and small numbers that you were using to expand.
Wait, you mean in terms of
symmetric?
Right. You're talking about in terms of the value of some field? Or what? What's the measure of
one of your parameters, which is one of the many parameters?
Right. Okay. But even so, I'm asserting that parameter has a potential. I mean, all these parameters are fields.
By the time you're talking about potential, you're already talking about something which is well below, which is not coming from string theory directly. Right?
Why?
You're saying we're going to represent everything in terms of some picture, which in the end looks like potential, like one does in conventional quantum mechanics.
That's fine. Field theory is a lower description of string theory. I mean, the scale of all these things is well below the string scale. I'm using field theory descriptions of things.
If you want a potential, I can have something which gets flatter and flatter and flatter. And infinity is where the ground theory is.
Oh, you can. There are, right, yes, you can get potentials like that.
Right.
But,
it's called quintessence.
Right. It's very hard to get a potential which is flat enough not to be ridiculous. I mean, that is the constant nature of changing so slowly. That a flat potential is much less likely. This is ridiculous along some axes, but along the axis of taking what we understand dynamically and pursuing it, it's not ridiculous. Yes. I'm going along a certain axis, which is not.
I have a different question. You said that you need 10 to the 60 or something.
Yes.
But really the entropic principle is, using the entropic principle, is just resigning to do a prediction, just to have probability on zero.
Mm-hmm.
So why do you need 10 to the 60? You just made an argument that maybe just by pure chance, you will have a probability non-zero of having just go back to exactly where you want.
But
why do you need to have a large probability?
This would be wonderful. String theory only has 10 vacua, and just by accident, one of them is in just the right place. That would be wonderful. I hope you're right. But, we only have one theory. It's not an ensemble of string theories to choose from.
What is the level of probability you need to invoke the anthropic principle?
It's just that you could non-zero.
According to what
I understand, it's not that it is.
This is in some at some level. Well, let's leave off the anthropic principle and just ask, what does it take dynamically to have a vacuum whose energy density is in this range? Again, these numbers are not functions of any parameters. They're pure numbers that come out of solving equations, and typically the number is 10 to the 60th times larger than the number that one sees in nature. So unless one is very lucky, you need 10 to the 60. You will get none. Yeah, the probability is it's not a probabilistic question. Within string theory, it's a deterministic question to which the answer is probably zero. The probability is our ignorance, not any indeterminacy in the theory. Yes.
The point in your theory very semi-classical, that if you are expanding around some manifold that I look very isn't it a bit strange? I mean, you would think that the thing maybe it's just more
the space-time manifold.
The four semi-classical picture is completely your own. I mean, for example, when David says the position of two things with different time structure constantly. Maybe it doesn't mean anything that the value of the time structure something well defined in this situation state.
There are sort of two halves of the question there. The first half is the reason that one can have any kind of classical approximation is because there is a small parameter. It's ultimately the small parameter I was mentioning, that closeness to supersymmetry, but it tells you that you're below the Planck scale, so the metric is classical. There are things that are classical. Now, even in the small directions, you have an approximate classical description generated by this small parameter. Again, there's another question which comes back to Dan's question that I still haven't understood, which is how we collapse onto a single value of the fine structure constant. But again, the same question comes up purely in the context of the fluctuations of that produce galaxies. How do we collapse onto a certain configuration of galaxies? And that's decoherence. It's the same. I'm sorry?
It seems to be a very large scale property with fine structure constant. And maybe at very small scale, there is no such thing as a fine structure constant. So you cannot even say that you are in the superposition of two spaces, two different fine structure constants.
There are certainly states of string theory where all dimensions are roughly the size of a string, all of them, and you can't apply any normal notions of geometry. In the context I'm discussing, there are at least three dimensions which are much larger than a string, and so you have normal notions of geometry. Now, in fact, I should say that when I say the physics that we see depends on the geometry of the internal space, we know that string theory modifies what we normally mean by geometry in certain specific ways, and so I really mean that more general thing. It's in fact, I'm describing the internal space as though it's a classical geometry. In fact, there are more general things that don't have a classical description, but it doesn't change anything I've said. They still have a discrete spectrum. The main point is they still have a discrete spectrum, and that's,
Is there anything in the theory that tells you the three large space dimensions will be geometrically flat?
The usual, that's all.
So it's inflation. It's nothing that came out of
No.
You can even have the entropic principle for that. You could have six flat, one flat, two flat, three flat.
Right. I didn't even really invoke the entropic principle. I just said there's galaxies here and not there.
Yeah, but why?
You live in a galaxy. What?
Well, that's only because you're around.
Well, right, I mean, I don't have to. You don't ask me to explain why we're not in the void between galaxies, because we couldn't live there. We're also not in this larger void that has no galaxies at all.
Once you're willing to invoke the fact that there are galaxies in order to reduce this,
yes,
you might as well. I mean, start invoking the whole schmear, which is what people do. Because those are also observational facts.
Right. The problem there is that we have no clear idea of what the right measure is. The probability distribution or the right measure even to begin to invoke that. If this is the way things go, someday people will do that because they will have no choice.
Well, if somebody has 120 wrong ideas, you go according to one thing, you will only measure over the
papers. Well, since we have a finite time to live because of the universe in which we live on, we will finally die, we will never answer the question. Our universe will become empty, essentially, and we are not going to survive, so we have a finite time to get the solution, something like 10 to the 10 years more.
Yes. You can all go, by the way, if you yes. You don't have to stay around and be polite. You can leave if this is boring you. But yes, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
David instructed that.
That's good. Yeah. Well, you.
I just want you to come back to something earlier on about why one might be sort of close to supersymmetric in some way.
Yes.
And you said, if I understood it, that at least as far as it's known, the non-supersymmetric solutions are not
stable.
Right.
And the ones that are closer to supersymmetric may be more stable.
Right.
So I mean, is it possible that one is sort of cascaded down, starting from some very non-supersymmetric one?
Yes.
And then got one which is stable enough to last the nano, and then we'll go into some other one that lasts exponentially longer or something.
Yeah, although more likely we'll go to one which is below zero, and those immediately collapse to a singularity.
Yeah.
Because if the ones are fully supersymmetric, there's still no mechanism. If we
really there is a mode of tunneling which takes our vacuum to a zero energy supersymmetric vacuum. Yeah, there is always going to be a mode of tunneling where
then it's completely stable.
Then it's actually that wouldn't well, the constants of nature would all change, so we would die right away. But in fact, the long-term history of the universe would be a supersymmetric Minkowski vacuum, right? Right.
No. I'm saying no.
I mean, if the cosmological constant had been zero, how many graduate students do you need, Joe? That's my question. I mean,
no, just one. To say it's supersymmetric.
If it were exactly
zero, everything that I've said is irrelevant because none of these will be exactly at zero. Barring some strange theoretical miracle. Yes.
Well, you said you would quit physics if it's not zero. So presumably,
not supersymmetric.
No, I know.
Yes. Oh, wait, but is there always a mode, if this is one of the unstable ones, that you can either hear, or can you be on a sequence that only goes down to there?
You have usually several paths, and there are relative rates.
But is there anything that could make it so that you didn't have paths,
except the only path is there,
or the most likely path
would
go down into there, right?
You know, possibly, Lenny is trying to... Lenny Susskind is trying, in some sense, to argue that cosmology sort of consists of a small number of non-supersymmetric bubbles within a larger supersymmetric space. So in some sense, he's arguing that we both began from, I don't fully understand his picture, but that we both began from and go into a state like this. You find that more satisfying somehow? Yeah. I mean, this is strange because when the entire universe goes into a big crunch,
much feeling of a metric as to what.
Right, right.
But that's why I was asking that other question. Wasn't too difficult because it's hard to know which thing wants to feel more unsatisfied. So I guess the analogy with the black holes, maybe I misunderstood the history.
I thought you were
always used to say we never have to worry about the high energy physics we don't understand because it's big black hole surfaces and the entropy paradox must be found within resolved within relativity and normal quantum mechanics and so on.
You're right. You're right.
And now it.
It got resolved in some way which is still not fully laid out. I want to run that by saying that physics is less local than we thought in some weird way.
Which in some way, to me at least, being completely out of the field, it seemed that the first time there was some sort of spark of saying that there must be something right about string theory was when it started contributing to that.
Because
it was something completely different from what it was trying to do. Right?
It's like
when quantum mechanics sort of started.
Absolutely.
Making... ways of possibly understanding
Well, it may very well be that, one of the issues, so the solution has to do with this holographic idea that you have this dual description in terms of non-local variables. We don't have any idea how to apply that in a cosmological context. We have no idea what is the dual description, where does it live, and so on. In a cosmological context.
But is there a reason to believe that there isn't such, or just one doesn't know how to do it?
No. In fact, we're trying very hard to find it. And indeed, it might be that once we do that, all the rules of the game are changed. This is in some sense the most conservative interpretation of all of the things that we understand.
I understand exactly what it was you were.
Okay, and it's not ugly. It's paradox. It's not paradox. It's ugly though, not paradoxical.
But I'm not saying the black hole example was one. Is one where the unconservative view at least seems to be more promising than the because no. One
I agree. Oh, I agree. I would much rather something
interesting. A thing like that, the holographic. The holographic way of describing.
I would much like I said. I one time I thought I'd give up physics if this happened, and maybe I have given up physics. Maybe that's the point.
I agree, but in general, that's not.
Yeah.
I guess not a completely unexpert, but the, yeah. I mean, I'm definitely an expert, but I think my standard as a biologist.
Yes, yes.
But you've managed to get something wrong.
No, people are taking the track, you know, something.
Well, the computer generated it, right? That's...
Well, he's got fat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's awful. Maybe I shouldn't have admitted to this, but it's, you know, this is...
This is the...
anyway. Matthew, can drag you back to some kinetic meta problems.
No, no. Don't make me say something.
But these things about